everyone to Human Centered Security. I'm Heidi Trost, and I'm here with David Mahdi, who has just told me that he threw away our notes for today, and he's just going to wing it. So this should be a really fun conversation. Thank you, David, for joining me. Really excited to have you.
Yeah, thank you, Heidi, and thanks to all the listeners as well for tuning in. No, I mean, hey, look, I'm actually like a big Curb Your Enthusiasm fan.
Oh, me too.
I don't know if you know this, but their whole style is like it's all improv. They have a general direction of the scene they're gonna do, right? So maybe at the end, Heidi throws a cup of water in David's face. That's how the scene has to end. But up to that point, we could, you know, we're improvising to get there. I'm very passionate about digital identity and obviously thinking about consumer experience, user experience. Identity is one of those things that it hits us right in the face multiple times a day. You know, you open up your laptop, you got to log in. You open up a web app, a mobile app, you got to log in. You got to use a biometric or a password, yay, or a PIN.
Well, before you dive in, I have two questions for you. First of all, where do you work?
I work at Transmit Security. So Transmit Security is an identity security and fraud vendor. That works with some of the world's largest financial institutions, well over a billion identities managed, with some of our, you know, cumulative customers managing wealth well over into the trillions. Very cool gig. I'm a CIO, and I've been at Transmit for about a year. Prior to that, I was at a PKI company for about a year as a CSO. And then prior to that, I was at Gartner as a VP analyst, covering identity, data security, and some other cybersecurity topics. And prior to that, I had various roles in product management. But I really started a long time ago as a hacker. So maybe that answered your second question.
That wasn't my second question, but I remember you telling me a little bit about that. That's very interesting. Do you want to tell the audience more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, so this is going back a long time ago, but I had a BBS and I...
What's a BBS?
A bulletin board system. Okay. dial up and all that. And I was really big into, you know, getting free software because I was like a kid, teenager, didn't have any money. So, and I wanted to play games and I wanted to, you know, do all that. It was mostly gaming. Okay. So I was like a PC gamer and I didn't have any money. And so I had to get free games, but then I very quickly realized in setting up a BBS, it was all about like sharing software to get, you know, so you have to share something that you have to get something. And, you know, people start to just trade stuff and all that. And, you know, you get into like freaking is like playing with the phone system. So you can like dial numbers in, say the United Kingdom. I was based in Canada. And I like try to call the UK and not pay long distance. That was kind of my first foray. And then, you know, people start saying, hey, why don't you just like, let's tack into these companies and stuff. So I did some bad things that I don't want to entirely talk about. Got in trouble, but everything was all good. But that honestly, Heidi, it really influenced me kind of later on. So I went to school to do engineering, had my heart set on becoming like a chip designer. And that was around the dot-com kind of boom and then bust. And when I graduated, there were like no jobs in chip design or ASIC design, which sucks because that's what I wanted to do. And then I found myself kind of getting back into cybersecurity, you know, with kind of like working for an antivirus company and went that route. So I'll stop there. I don't want to bore the audience with all that stuff. But
if you could just sum it up in like a few sentences, what do you think you learned that you might be able to pass on to folks who are trying to build more secure experiences?
Yeah. The biggest thing I would say is thinking about your adversaries. They don't have any red tape and they're very creative thinkers. And that was kind of the biggest lesson that I had back in the day. And what I would implore anyone who's in the space now, if you're, you know, to sometimes just try to take 20 steps back away from your, you know, your NIST frameworks and all that kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you're kind of saying like they have no rules. So if you're expecting there to be rules, surprise, there aren't any, right?
Exactly. It's totally an asymmetric game where
Yeah.
the good actors have to do all these checklists and prove that they have, their SOC certified and like ISO certification, and we applaud the, like all the privacy laws and all this. They're good in spirit, but then sometimes it forces this, I don't want to say lazy logic, but I'll just say it, like lazy logic where you go, oh, well, we did all this certification, so we should be secure. Again,
Right.
attackers will find a way in, and they don't have to waste time with compliance.
Yep.
Sorry,
Yeah,
it's
it's so
true.
true. Well, okay, so that you started off our conversation talking about identity. Can you explain what identity means?
Yeah, so I guess we'll say, Heidi, specifically digital identity, right? I think with identity, if we were to define it, the cleanest way is like just thinking about yourself. You've got Heidi as a citizen, and you've got, maybe digital identities associated to that. Heidi as a consumer, you might have a bank digital identity. That's, what you log in. They have an identity stored for you. I'll get into that in a second and what that means and the implications of that. Your social networks, so that's like your personal life. So we have all these personas, right? Or Heidi does, and I do, and your corporate identity, all that kind of stuff. And as we get more into the digital world, some of the infrastructure is actually very similar, where you think about a corporate identity, let's just use that. There is typically a directory, and that directory is what kind of houses your identity. And it would say, here's Heidi. This is her role in the organization. This is maybe the organizational unit she's in. And then these are the entitlements that she has. She can access these applications, these databases, and what have you. And your role over time might change, right? There's a term in identity that they call joiner, mover, leaver. Joiner is like when you joined the organization, or when you're joining a new bank as your bank account. They have to do an onboarding process, and that process would be like doing a background check, making sure you say who you are, looking at all these types of things. Once they know, yeah, this is Heidi, then they go, let's move to the next phase, and that's creating a digital identity for her. That's going into the directory and creating that and saying what's her role. So in your organization, let's just say you're in finance, you get access to all of these types of things. So that's the J part. The M part would be mover. Now, Heidi started in finance and she wants to get into UX in cybersecurity team. So they go, okay, now we need to, she's not leaving the organization, so we're not deleting her identity, but what we're going to do, ideally, they shouldn't create a new one. They should just move you. And they would change your organizational unit to say cybersecurity, and change your role to like say UX design or something like that. And then that will downstream change, hopefully change the applications you would have access to. You shouldn't have access to maybe those financial systems anymore because that's not the scope of your job. That's what a mover is. So someone who's moving the organization. Just while we're on that point, that's where sometimes people have trouble from a security perspective is as you've moved people in the organization, they may still have access to these systems that they shouldn't have anymore. And not to say that you're a bad person, Heidi, but that's what attackers also take advantage of. If they attack you and get to Heidi's identity, what they do is they look at what Heidi has access to and they go, oh, that's interesting. This user has access to this system. I'm going to use that. And typically, they look for those power users that have access to privilege users, really, is the term, have access to a lot of stuff. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that when we're on mover. Leaver is now you decide to leave the organization. Ideally, they shouldn't have an orphaned account. Orphaned account, again, is they didn't delete Heidi's account and it's just sitting there idle, and an attacker could go after that and access everything you had. But ideally, they would like delete everything, and that identity wouldn't exist. So that's kind of like digital identity in a sense. It's you have really like the data about the user. There could be with generally like banks and stuff, they'll have like, your name, your age, other things. Some of them, which I think is naughty, Storing the social security numbers. I think there's so many providers that don't need that, but some of those are stored in the identity kind of profile, age, address, you name it. And those are what's called attributes. And those attributes, are quite valuable within these systems. So that's a part of your identity. And then last piece, and I'll pause, is your access mechanisms. Now, I know on one podcast you had, it was on passwordless. And so this is the general market term is called authentication. So now you have an identity. How do you access your account on a daily basis? Or how do you access your corporate account or these personal accounts you have? And that's where there's the practice of authentication comes in. And that's typically what we've used for decades has been passwords. But obviously we're trying to move away from that for security reasons and move to things like passkeys or passwordless methods, biometrics, or you name it. And so you use one of those methods, it's tied to your identity. And that's kind of what unlocks your services. Okay, there's a lot. I'll stop there.
So identity is how the system knows it is you. It's basically a representation of you, your digital identity. Authentication is a way to prove you are who you say you are. So if I log in as Heidi, I use my authentication method, say it's passkeys, and that proves to the system, okay, this actually is Heidi. And then you also talked about privileges. So what am I authorized to do? Right. So if I'm in finance, I'm allowed to do what the folks in finance are allowed to do. If I'm on UX, I'm allowed to do what the folks on UX are supposed to do.
That so no, you nailed the definitions though. You nailed it. I think I'll do a couple of things. So I was at Gartner for a while and in the identity team, and I used to run a presentation for a number of years, and it was IAM 101. And because we found
Oh,
that
I wish I could
our
take this class.
Well, I mean, so I'll give you one of the slides. So one of the slides is what is IAM, identity and access management. Okay, so what is it? IAM enables the right people for the right reasons to get access to the right resources at the right times to enable the right business outcomes. So a lot of use of the word right. Now we can actually, by the way, it's not just humans. There's also machines that need identities, but that is a whole other can of worms that we could get into because machines are also around. So that's software and all sorts of things. But that's really the definition of identity. And application. So the way how IAM all started was every application had its own identity store. And if you think about an organization, they have a word processor, they've got like an operating system and all this. And so it became very challenging for organizations to scale that. You'd have different passwords for everything. If you left the organization or changed jobs, again, with join, remove, or leave, or how do you do that? So it was like, 25 plus years ago, the birth of identity and access management systems, where they would centralize it. And so when Heidi would join an organization, centrally they can say, she's in finance, create the identity and then give her access to all the stuff she needs. So I'm looping this back. So the birth of IAM, it came out of productivity and not security per se. What we're seeing today is attackers. Again, they look for holes in how they can get in any way, and they're creative and they go, wait a minute. Everyone's trying to give people the most access to the most things, to make not get in Heidi's way. I want Heidi to be extremely productive. So I'm not going to deny her access to any of these systems because she's going to ask me and I'm just going to give her access. That's what attackers are preying on right now is organizations give access to everybody. All at the same time. And so that's why ransomware is a problem. Ransomware is actually an access problem. I actually argue it's not a malware problem. We know how to deal with malware. We don't know how to deal with excess access. Anyway, I'll stop. You can tell like
Well,
I'm
that's, I mean, you
super.
bring up like a total user experience issue, right? Like the reason that, well, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert here, but it seems like the reason that you would give folks a bunch of access is because it's so annoying for, my direct reports to come to me and be like, can I have this? Can I get this? Can I get this? And now I have to go in and like, click the box and say, yes, I approve, right? Like it's annoying. So,
Yes.
we just give them more access than maybe. Yeah, so for example, maybe you need a piece of software, or you need access to for a particular project, right? Like you really just need it for this one thing. And
Yeah.
honestly, it could be turned off after that. You really don't need it. But like
Yeah.
obviously no one ever goes and turns it off, right? Because that would
No,
be a waste of
we're all
stuff.
busy. Yeah, we
Yeah.
no. I Heidi, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, absolutely. It is all about user experience. As we've become more of a digital economy, all the workers are we're on computers, we're on devices, and I think we're using like 20, 30-year-old models to try and deal with this world. And it's 2024 now, and I you
Are you
know
going
I
to tell us what the new model, tell us what the future is?
oh my gosh, okay. That's a
30
whole other
seconds or
thing.
less. No, I'm
Well,
just
look,
kidding.
I do think that the spirit of the last podcast, I absolutely do believe in passwordless authentication. It's going to come. It's not going to come overnight though. And there's a few reasons for that. One, there's a lot of legacy systems out there that are just, remember I told you that identity system, some of them are hard coded with passwords. Some applications that still exist and they're 30, 40 years old, 50 years old that are in our governments today, and they can't really just switch them over. Those are hard coded to use passwords. So it's not going to be an overnight thing, but we understand it's a problem and the models are coming in place. So
Can
it's
you
very
just take pause to explain what passwordless and what pass keys are, just in case folks don't know what they are?
yeah, excellent point.
Those
Excellent
words.
point. So let's start with passwordless. So pass keys are just a modality, if you will. But passwordless is you're not having to exchange a password for an authentication event. So think of it like in a couple phases. There's the UX experience of passwordless, which is purely just I go to log in to even my phone. And I use a biometric to get in. I'm not using a password to log in. Or an application could use my camera or a fingerprint reader to get into a web app, right? So that to the user is a passwordless experience. Security-wise, the idea would be, well, in order for an attacker to get into the application, they need to have the device I'm using, and they have to have my fingerprints or my face in order to get in. So it raises the bar for security. It's not flawless, but it's good. So passwordless is trying to balance out the security with that usability. But if I go a step further, true passwordless is that plus the elimination of actual passwords in the system. Because I should say, sometimes when you're using biometrics or whatever, they're not necessarily, it depends on what how they're doing it, but they could they're still generally a password that's in a database somewhere that's associated to your account. And if someone gets to that password, they could still use that to reset your account and enroll a brand new mobile phone, and I could put my fingerprints in there, and the system doesn't know that those aren't Heidi's fingerprints. It doesn't have that knowledge. So we just assume that I'm Heidi, right? And by the way, that's a big form of attack. That was a part of the MGM attack, was doing an account reset through the help desk. But the true future of passwordless would be using, biometrics, using all these different types of modes, because I don't think there's any one mode that's better. I think it all depends on the use case and the device you're on.
And
But actually,
accessibility too, just to throw that out there.
no, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's an excellent point. You have to think about that. While we're just on that, I mean, I had clients that I had worked with that they had people who worked in labs. And so they were wearing like clean suits. So the only thing we could use was retina or iris, because those are the only, because their fingers were covered in gloves and their bodies were covered. And so you can't do facial recognition. You can't do, fingerprint reads. So yeah, you have to think about accessibility and even disabilities too, as well, right? So it covers all that. But the future, I think, is actually eliminating those passwords in those systems, so that when Heidi logs in, it's using and I won't get into the weeds, but it's using like strong cryptography to do those authentication events. And that's kind of where like pass keys are just a mode where passwords can still exist in the system, but you're using these pass keys to authenticate. And they can, there's different types. You can use them on multiple devices, or they're tied to a singular device and all that. It'll stop there. I have a bad habit of just going on and on and on,
No,
but
that's perfect. And
yeah.
that's helpful. Well, it also drives home the point when you say like it's going to be a process to go to passwordless. Like even with the introduction of pass keys, a lot of systems will continue to have passwords. And until it's completely passwordless, you still have the issues, inherent in using passwords.
100%. It this anything to do with identity, it takes a village. What do I mean by that, right? So let's just go on authentication. There's this really, really amazing group. Shout out to the FIDO Alliance, FIDO Alliance, the Fast
Oh,
Identity.
yes. Kevin in our last episode was from the FIDO
Ex
Alliance. Yes.
exactly. And so it's folks like him and organizations like him that have come together, and what they've done is it's they've built that village by having Microsoft, Google, Amazon, the company I work for, Transmit, Intel, MasterCard, like Samsung, it goes on and on, LG, it goes on and on and on, all kinds of organizations. You can go to FIDO's website and see the long
If
list.
you want to sponsor those
Yeah,
podcasts.
exactly, right? Exactly. They've got they basically had to assemble a village. Why? Well, because if you go and buy a Microsoft Surface book or tablet, and you use Windows Hello, that's compatible with FIDO, right? They had to get Microsoft to start leveraging in their browsers and in their software and in their hardware, all those passwordless methods that FIDO has the specifications for. Same thing with the LG phones, LG devices, Samsung phones, Samsung devices. And so the browsers, you've got like Apple and Google with Chrome and Edge with Microsoft. They all support FIDO. So it takes a village in order for it to work. And I spent a lot of time working for a company called SecureKey, where we worked very closely with the Canadian government to launch a really cool identity service that Canadians have access to. And then when I joined Gartner, there was myself and another analyst where we kind of led the coverage of decentralized identity. And when we first came out with it, we called it blockchain identity. And then we quickly changed it to decentralized identity, and now I think Gartner says DCI, and it's on the hype cycle and all that stuff. Okay, so what is it? Really, what it is a it's a form of bring your own identity. Okay, so we're all familiar with bring your own device, similar concept, but bring your own identity, right? And it's not an alien concept to any of us. It shouldn't be. Think of it this way: identity is very similar to payments. But let's think about the physical world for a moment. When you walk into a physical store, a lot of stores might have on the window the logos of credit card networks, right? Why do they do that? Well, they're trying to let you know that, hey, we try to remove all the barriers for you to buy stuff from us. So if you come in here, you can buy a cup of coffee with Amex, with MasterCard, with cash, with a debit or Visa or you name it, right? And so you're like, oh, okay, cool. I'm gonna go there because I can use one of my payment credentials. Well, websites and digital services can and should be like that too. So when you approach a digital service, rather than forcing you to create an account, it can say, hey, Heidi, like we are a coffee mug company, and we have a loyalty program. Do you want to join the loyalty program? Oh, by the way, you don't need to create an identity with us. You could use Facebook, you could use Google, you could use Amazon or whatever. Now, that might be a lower security one. Maybe that coffee mug company is not regulated insanely. But if it's a government or a bank, they could, but they might need what's called a higher assurance identity. So
You're not
maybe
gonna
another
lie
bank.
at your Facebook account. That's
Yeah,
not gonna
I
fly. Though
no.
it's all about risk. Like, so if we're just like, we're talking to folks in UX, like it's the higher the risk, like the greater the confidence, right? That's kind of
Exactly,
a
exactly.
zero trust concept is
Exactly.
confidence. We need a higher level of confidence.
Exactly. But again, the thing that excited me when I met you is like, again, I'm like an identity cybersecurity person. And when I think about things like bring your own identity, I'm like, at the very heart and soul of that is user consumer experience, UX and CX, because when a user approaches a website, it is so much friction to have to create an account, notwithstanding the privacy and security implications when you have to create a new identity with somebody. But the usability is it's so nice when you can go to a website and you can sign in with an ID that you already have, and then you can go back and you're not having to go like, oh, what was my login again? Oh, I have to do a reset. It's just like, and then it goes to my
Yeah, but then
email.
there's a whole other host of problems with now we need to get everybody onboarded onto these new programs, right? Like it's a whole it seems like a great solution, but it also comes with it its own set of user experience issues.
Exactly. And I think, again, like, and we haven't, I'm kind of leaning towards decentralized identity, but I just pop back to this for a moment. It does come very heavy-handedly with authentication, because I think where the world is going, that's what future as well is, like these identity wallets. And so we're already familiar with digital wallets today. If you use Apple Pay or Google Pay or Samsung Pay, right? You go into that wallet, you can pick your card and you tap it on the reader. Well, that same core tech could be applied for you to authenticate into a website, so digitally, or even if you went to a coffee shop, physically, you could use your wallet and use some other form of ID or something, right? Because I'm from Canada originally, and I don't know, like, you look at some folks in the identity space, and there are a lot of Canadians in the identity space. I think it's because we're like the, we're very like, we're like siblings, US and Canada. But we're like, Canadians, we're like the smaller country. So we got this, we have like, we just always have an identity crisis, and we're always thinking about identity. And so, one of the things in Canada that we take very seriously is privacy. So, we like, so for example, it's like, technically, if you go to, say, buy a bottle of wine at a store and then someone asks you for your ID, they don't need to know when you were born. They don't need to know your address. They don't need to know like the your driver's license number. They don't need to know any of that. In fact, that's too much information for them to have. Even when they swipe it, and I've recently relocated to the US, and that really bothers me, is when people are swiping my ID. I'm like, why do you, you're just gonna end up getting breached. Why do you need all this information? And usability wise, this is just painful for me as a customer. Like, you should just, ask me for my ID or something. But ideally, we would be able to take our phone and tap it onto a reader. And on the phone, it just says, do you consent to share an age verification? I'll clarify verification and not age. And you just like say yes, and I do my fingerprint, and boom. The clerk, all they see on their screen is my face and a green check mark. So that's
Right.
verification. All they need to know is, am I 21 or above? That's it. And now they don't have volatile data that's stored in their system, because they don't need that data, right? So anyway, I'll stop there. But it comes, so to me, there's like usability, security, and privacy, and all of these things are really smashing together in this whole identity world. And bring your own identity is a good way of solving it, because my view right now is every website on the planet that's doing something, they're all becoming identity providers. And my view is that they don't want to be identity providers. Like that coffee mug company, they want to sell coffee mugs, right?
Right.
But banks, telcos, governments, some other orgs, they have invested, and they're regulated to do so, in the people, the process, and the technology to secure all that stuff. And then they can kind of host that. So they're good custodians of digital identity. And perhaps we can get to a world where you could use your bank ID to log into certain high assurance things, or if it's low assurance, use Facebook or whatever. So that's kind of what I see in the future. It's going to take some time. It takes a village. It takes parties, ecosystems, and players to work well
Do
together.
you think that's something that something like the FIDO Alliance would have to take on, like an organization like that? Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a lot of over. So FIDO has been very much focused on authentication, and they're starting to expand and to get into, again, it's other identity related things. I can't speak on behalf of FIDO because I'm not like a, part of their board, and I don't run FIDO. But there are organizations that are trying to set standards for decentralized identity, for bring your own identity. And I think what I should just say too, Heidi, because I love how you're asking for the definitions as well for the audience. So let me just define standards and explain why it's important in the identity space, say with FIDO and say with just decentralized identity. Think about Bluetooth for a moment, right? And think about your car and your headphones and all this. And if you had to install proprietary drivers for each one of those things to work with each other. Think
Yeah,
about
like
these.
you had to do with printers like back in the day. You're like, oh
Oh,
my God, new printer.
exactly, right? So that's terrible for UX. It's just terrible for scale. It's terrible, and there's not really anything good about it practically. Yeah, sure, there's some pros in there, but they're totally outweighed by all those cons. So when the world kind of was introduced to Bluetooth a long time ago, and when vendors, Apple, Google, Samsung, car manufacturers, you name it, when they all started using Bluetooth, now I know I could go to a Best Buy, buy a pair of Bluetooth headphones, and it'll pair with my laptop, it'll pair with my TV, it'll pair with my phone. My phone can pair with my car. I don't have to worry about all that. And so those standards really provided a great ecosystem for all these digital services on mobile devices and laptops and smart TVs to just grow. And that's kind of what FIDO did for authentication. They introduced, let's just say, the Bluetooth for authentication, and all of those hardware vendors, software vendors could build to that one FIDO spec, and now you can authenticate, and it can be a very similar user experience. So we're in, I would say, the early stages of decentralized identity, but those are the conversations that are going on with working groups,
Can
with
you
the.
point people in where they should look? Like, who should they follow to kind of stay on top of this stuff?
Yeah, so there's one group I'm involved with called the Accountable Digital Identity Association, so ADIA. There's like W3C. There's a number of them that are out there where they all kind of have these specifications that where they're looking at it. Now, they're also, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but there are also some country regional specific ones. Like in Europe, they have what's called eIDAS, so eIDAS, and now they're kind of on version two. And Europe is actually going to be introducing or mandating a digital wallet by 2030, I believe, last I checked. And they really want to try to get European citizens to go all digital. Like I'll give kudos to the Canadian government, because when I was at a SecureKey, when we worked with them to so in so I'll just describe it. So in Canada, when you go to pay your taxes, you go to the CRA. It's equivalent to the IRS. And of course, most people only do it once a year. And so when you're going to this website, everyone always forgets their credentials, so you reset. And they would send like a token, like a code in the mail, and so it was just painful for usability, delays, and then it costs the government tons of money. Okay. So they leveraged a service from SecureKey, which is now Interac. It's called verified.me, or I think that's the name. And so when you go to the website, they have three options to account for that, Heidi, what you're talking about, accessibility. So they don't just say it's this way or the highway. They say, okay, we'll give you option one. And option one is use a sign-in partner, AKA we support high assurance bring your own identity. So when you go to the CRA website today and you click on option one, it shows you a list of all of the major Canadian banks, typically, and their other financial services that are in there, like Bank of Montreal, and others. that you could click on that bank. If you're a customer of that bank, it brings you to the bank's website. You log in with your account, and then it actually privately authenticates you into your tax account. Very cool, because now you don't you didn't have to worry about your government account. It used your bank ID to log in. Great. But only some Canadians will do that. So then they said, you know what, we need a second option. And I think the second option now is a couple provinces have their own identity schemes. So in Canada, we have provinces that say like they're like states. And so they have their own ID cards that also have a digital identity associated with it. So that's option two. So if you live in British Columbia, you could use a British Columbia ID to log into your Canadian federal tax account. Very cool. And then they're like, okay, we have a third option. And that was the like basically the old school username and password that they're still keeping there, because of that. Like basically, if you think about equity and inclusion, if you're underbanked or you're not, or you don't want to, or you're worried, you don't want to share your bank account for whatever reason, they're giving people those three options. When it comes to bring your own identity, I am a big believer in giving as many options as possible, as with authentication. Don't force me to use fingerprint. Allow me to choose an equivalent security level one that I could use. Because by the way, living in Ottawa, Canada, in the middle of winter, my fingers were always cracked, and a lot of fingerprint readers just wouldn't work. So, you need to have the multiple options to be able to log in, authenticate, and use your identity. So just wanted to call that out. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Threat actors are creative. They have no rules. So they're just going to find new and creative ways to get around this, to get around decentralized identity. It's like, okay, cool. Now you've given me a new challenge. I'm going to go after this. Like, so what are some things that we can think about from that mindset, on like where attackers might be going next?
So I was actually last week, I was in Nashville with a lot of CISOs of major financial institutions, and I wish I could say the person's name because it was an awesome comment, but they work in security identity for a large financial institution, and they said, attackers are like water, right? They'll always find a way, because they're trying to get to like an exposure point, right? It's like plumbing, right? You're like, I tightened everything, and yet there's like still water dripping through, right? So that's kind of what they're like. So they're always going to find a way in. That's just the nature of it. We will never be able to eliminate all possibilities for attackers to get in. We just won't. We just will not. So all we can do is a couple things. So first and foremost, we can mitigate attacks. We can minimize damage. So, for example, we talked at the beginning of this conversation about access. If we constantly are reviewing people's access and we right size your access all the time, you're minimizing the attack surface potentially, right? There's still an attack surface, but you're minimizing. You're not having Heidi still have access to finance if now she's in UX design or cybersecurity. We've shrunk that down. So those are some things you can do. But the core point is really, and I've heard a lot of folks say this, and again, as an attacker, is you have to make it very as difficult as you could possibly make it for the bad actors. Right now, there are a lot of companies that make it too hard for legitimate users, forcing very poor UX. And trust me, having recently moved to the US from Canada, and doing a lot of banking, I appreciate the financial institutions of their concern over fraud, but I feel like I've been treated like a fraudster when I'm trying to get access to my money, and that's been problematic. But they want to increase the price of or effort and or price or cost of an attacker getting in, and by doing that, they look at you and they go, oh, that's too difficult for me to go for. I'm going to move somewhere else. So the real world analogy would be like physical security for your house. Here's some 2 points of advice. One, get motion sensor lights. If your house is well lit, a burglar is going to be like, oh, I don't really want to go into that house that has all the lights on, or there's all the lights there. There's a house next door or next door to that that's completely dark. I'm going to go after that. That's just the way how it works. It's like that slowest deer type mentality, right? Wolves won't go for the fastest, they'll go for the slowest, right?
Yeah.
And it's if you've got a little dog that's loud, that's better than no dog. Again, it's increasing that effort for the attacker, because they're like, oh, I'm gonna rob Heidi's house. I'm like, but I have to deal with this yappy dog that's there, or I could break into another house that doesn't have a dog at all. So people who or orgs that leverage these technologies and balance usability where they can, will not be totally impenetrable, but they'll be able to at least mitigate some of these attacks. And I think taking the mindset of the adversary, trying to put yourself in the shoes of how they think, you have to do that. And last thing I'll say, Heidi, is compliance doesn't mean a risk reduction. You have to think of both. You have to think of, okay, I have to comply to all these rules. Okay, go and do that, because you'll get in trouble if you don't. But you also have to think about your actual risk that affects you and your organization, and invest in the people, process, and tech that will help reduce that risk. And like I said, just make it harder for attackers to get in, and don't make it hard for your legitimate users. All right. That's my piece.
There's a well-known UX expert and person in our field named Jared Spool, and he calls what you just described selective usability. So you want to make it really hard for attackers, but you want to make it as easy as possible for legitimate users. Selective usability, and it's obviously something that's really hard to achieve. But I think the term is really interesting. It's very apt to describe
Yeah,
that tension.
100%, 100%. It's always a challenge to figure out who are the bad actors and who are the good. And but I think that's where, if we have like good identity systems where we can rely on other types of identities to say, hey, well, this one might be compromised, but Heidi could pick two others to log in, that increases the confidence. And now we can be selective about what you can and can't do, and that makes it a lot harder for attackers. So yeah.
I like it. Well, okay. So, we only have a few minutes left. Do you have any advice for UX designers? And I'll just leave it open-ended.
Yeah, no, I mean, so my advice would be, it like certainly look at Fido if you haven't looked at it, because if you're building applications and all this, like, you have to have security built in, okay? And we don't want security, but we have to have security nowadays. We're well past that tipping point. So if we have to live with security, how can we make it as easy as possible for people? I think passwordless authentication is a really, really good way to dip your toe into that ocean. So when you're thinking about UX, Fido, actually on their website, they've got a lot of interesting kind of documentation and stuff to show you what they're doing there. Start to familiarize yourself with things like bring your own identity. I mean, we already see websites that allow you to log in with Facebook and Google and all this. But if you're a UX designer that's, say, working at a bank or an e-commerce company where you need something, a little higher, start to look at your jurisdiction at what could be available, because say in Canada, you could possibly leverage some of these networks. So someone could in the future log in with a bank ID, which now you have like a really strong assessment of that. And so just because your org may not be doing something directly with identity, UX designers still have to deal with identity no matter what in their accounts, because you always want to be able to like identify people. And then the last thing, it's not really in your purview, but it is, because we're all there. If you find that you're working with folks in your organization that are forcing you to collect as much information as possible, just be cognizant of that. Because I think, the more you ask your users for information, that is actually a degradation of UX, especially if you don't need it. Don't ask for social security numbers if you don't need those, for example. So
Yeah,
I
I
just
tell
want to.
designers to question, like, do we really need to gather this information? And that's a completely legitimate question to ask.
100%, 100%.
Well, so David, if folks want to learn more from you, if they want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
I mean, certainly I think LinkedIn is a good way. I'll make a plug for a podcast I do generally every week. Sometimes I miss it just because of travel. It's called The Week in Identity. I do with my good friend Simon Moffat. He's an industry analyst, and we just talk about the week in identity, what happens. So if you're interested in those identity topics, you can go check that out. And yeah, and then certainly I typically attend conferences like RSA, Identiverse, some of the Gartner ones. So if you want to have a chat, just reach out on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, David. This has been so enlightening. I learned a lot, and I'm sure listeners have too. So thank you again.
Awesome. No, thank you, Heidi.